Hello, everyone. I'm Luis, and this is The Debrief, a podcast from Incident.io. Whether you're a seasoned company with 10 plus years of operations, or a startup that's just getting off the ground, making sure you have a really good culture of engineering is super important. Not only will this have a significant impact on the folks on your team, it'll make a difference with hiring. When everyone knows that your company is the place to be when it comes to culture, attracting really good talent becomes that much easier. But I was curious, what do some of the folks at Incident.io think about engineering culture in general and how best to build it? Better yet, what about engineering culture at Incident.io? What's it like? To answer all of these questions and more, I sat down with Lisa, tech lead, and Alicia, engineering manager, to get their perspectives on this incredibly important topic. We chat about what culture even means, why diversity is important, how teams can make sure their engineers feel empowered to share their perspectives, and a whole lot more. I think this was an incredibly fun conversation, so I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. So here it is. Here's my conversation with Lisa and Alicia. So today we're here to talk about engineering culture, but before we do that, let's just start with quick intros. I know that both of you have been on episodes of The Debrief before, but for folks who are just meeting you for the first time, I think it would be helpful for them to get acquainted with who each of you are and what your backgrounds are and what you do here at Incident. So Alicia, can we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm an engineering manager here at Incident.io. I've been here for 1 year and 4 months. I look after the response team primarily, and of course do things like engineering in general. My background is in engineering. I was a software engineer for a long time before I moved into management, and I've been a manager now for about 4 years.
Yeah, I'm Lisa. I am the tech lead of the response team. So that's the team that Alicia runs. Been here 2.5 years. So since we were like 5 people in a very, very small office. So kind of very exciting to see where we are now and look back on that journey. It's quite mad. But yeah, so before that, I was done some engineering at some other like sort of scale-ups in London, and then a long time ago, I was a consultant at Accenture.
Yeah, you have been here for since the very beginning, and I think that's something that I would really love to talk about later on in our conversation, is like the evolution of our culture since you joined and where we're at right now. I can imagine things are quite different. But let's start off with a pretty broad question. What exactly does culture mean to you? Lisa, let's stick with you for this.
So I think culture is about the way that people work together. So if you imagine that you're like a one-person company, I don't think that one-person company really has culture. That's just like your personality. So I see culture as being the way that different people's personalities interact at like the base level. And then as an organization, you start to want to influence that culture, because obviously the way that different people's personalities interact changes the decisions that you make as a company. So as an example, if you have 6 people who are really like really risk tolerant, so they'll take loads and loads of risks and they're very comfortable in that, that becomes the culture of your organization and it kind of emerges. And that might be something that's a really good fit for your business. So for us in the early days, we wanted to take a lot of risks. That was what we were here for. If you are maybe in a financial sector and you're dealing with like regulators or large enterprise businesses, that might not be what you want your culture to be. And so there are lots of things you can do as an organization to start to influence that, and also try and isolate the things that make it magic, the things that are giving you the success that maybe for us, for example, we had in the first year, and then trying to double down on that. And so it's kind of about identifying like your personality as an organization. And I think there's a lot of soft skills there. There's a lot of the how do people interact? How does it feel to be in the office? Like we use the word vibe an awful amount at this company, but approximately speaking, like what's the vibe? But also that translates a lot to what are the decisions and trade-offs you're making in a much more sort of engineering or sales or in whatever part of the organization is you're in, you're always making trade-offs and decisions and prioritizing certain things over other things. And I think if you try and influence that, you end up talking about culture. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I think like I agree like very much so. And I think, you know, talking about the sort of personalities and coming together, like, you know, you go from 1 to 6 and then you start to create a culture. I think like you said, then you want to get the organization into it. And I think that's the environment. right? That's the processes that support that way of thinking and the sort of communications across teams. Like, how does that work that fits in with the sort of natural culture that has grown here? And I think that's really important. Like, the organicness of culture is really important. And then just sort of, I don't know, like slowly steering that in the direction that you need the business to go in is kind of like the way that I would look at it.
This may be a tricky question to answer, but I'm curious, have you seen organizations that sort of work backwards? So both of you sort of said that it makes the most sense to, you know, have your, you know, handful of initial hires in place, get a feel for what their skill sets are, the vibes that they bring to the table, and then start setting your culture based off of that. What about an organization that comes into the room saying, I want our culture to be X and we're going to hire for this? Does that approach make sense, or does that sort of pigeonhole you into like a very specific worldview?
I don't think there's such a distinction between those things. If I think about the way that we grew this company, like at the beginning, you know, when I was chatting to the founders, that was almost entirely like a culture fit exercise. It was, what are the things that you care about? What are the things that you prioritize? What's the kind of environment you want to work in? And so I think that kind of emergent culture, we can pretend it's an accident, but most people when they hire, particularly very early stage, you're going to be hiring people who think like you, who you trust, and you're going to trust people who have approximately the same values and the same culture. So I think that you kind of end up at the same outcome. I think there is a big variation on how intentional you are about that, and also like how much you talk about it. So I think there are some people, and I would put us in that category, where even from the early days, we were always talking about culture. And we were thinking about, we had a culture interview or a values interview. You know, we are always trying to look for people who we think are going to bring something to the culture and who are going to fit in and also enjoy like what we are bringing. And I think that there are other companies where that becomes a bit of an afterthought, where maybe the hiring process is much more focused on skills. And you can end up with some real clashes. And the flip side of that is you can end up with something amazing because you haven't thought about it at all, right? If you throw like six people in a room who are totally different, you might get something incredible and end up with an emergent culture that's really interesting and a bit different. Or you might end up with chaos and a lot of early exits and, you know, people falling out because they don't fundamentally want to run the business in the same way and make the same trade-offs. So I think it's a more risky approach if you're less intentional.
Yeah, I think like if I was to like start my own business, I would be thinking very strongly about what type of people I want to hire first for what I need done initially, right? And then from there, like it grows and like, what do I need now? What do I need now? What do I need now? And like, that's that sort of evolution of culture as your business grows is the way that I would look at it. So I think it is intentional, but it's organic in the way that once the people are in the room, it's not like, this is how you act. It's like, we've hired these people because of how they act. Go and do what you do best.
Alicia, let's stick with you. I'm really curious, when you first started your career, what was your perception of a strong culture, particularly a strong engineering culture?
I think when I first started my career, I didn't have a perception of what a strong culture, culture in terms of workplace, and then secondary culture in terms of engineering. I was winging it for a long time and trying to figure it out. I think when culture started to become important to me is later on in my career. My first role, I was like the only girl on the team, which is like a very common thing. And I was like trying to fit into what existed, not knowing that I could like, I don't know, influence culture, I suppose. And I think when I started to influence culture is when I joined like sort of a bigger company, and I was like, I can like collaborate with these people, and like this is what sort of culture and this is what good feels like, and then starting to make suggestions or like influence and push certain things, like, oh, we should be thinking more about this and we should be working more like this. And I guess that's why I tend to like lean into management, right? Because these are things I think about and care about. And then becoming a manager, I'm like, okay, this is like
part of my job.
This is my job. This is my responsibility now. Like, how do I think about this thing and how do I want people to work together? And for me, I'm vibes orientated. I want people to enjoy what they're doing, like very much. So I want people to be excited about the things that they're doing. So I guess that's what I start to like push for. Push is a strong word because I'm not a pushy person, but I guess that's what, how I behave to influence others to behave in a similar way.
So Alicia, I actually wanted to follow up on one of your points that you just made right now. So you mentioned coming in and sort of getting a lay of the land and looking for like basically process improvement. So you're coming in, you're saying to yourself, hey, I'm noticing that this is this way. Maybe we should think about it this way, you know, so on and so forth. But does that cause a little bit of anxiety knowing that you're basically like the new kid on the block and people may be perceiving you as someone who's coming in and trying to like change the culture that they have in place?
Yes, is the short answer. It's really unnerving coming in as a manager and like everybody's looking at you like, oh my God, this person's going to manage me. Like, how are they going to treat me? How are they going to like develop my career? Are they going to be good? I know like me, like I have those feelings when a new manager comes in, like, who is this person? You know? So yes, it is unnerving. I think for me, the thing that I think is really important to do when you're in that position is nothing. Come in and don't do anything. Talk to people, understand the culture, get to know everybody. Let them know, I'm not going to change anything. I'm not doing anything. I'm here to understand. I'm here to figure things out. Sit quietly in the room, take notes. When I first joined, I had like a list of notes of like things I would change. And I just like slowly wrote them down until I felt like I understood why things were the way they are. I think it's really easy to come into an organization and be like, this stand-up's terrible, I'm going to change it. But without understanding why that stand-up is like that, there could be like a very, very good reason for it. Understand that reason and then make your change or suggest change or improvement. So for me, it is anxiety inducing. The best way to handle that is to do nothing and let people know that you're planning on doing nothing.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you say that because last week I spoke to Norberto, our new VP of engineering, and I asked him like, so what are you doing over the next like 30, 60 days. And his response was basically the same. Like, I'm here to listen. I'm here to absorb these first, you know, few weeks, months. It's not about doing work. It's about taking a back seat, letting things play out, joining daily stand-ups, joining meetings, and just kind of being in a corner and listening to what people are saying and not coming in very heavy-handed at first, like with an iron fist and saying, okay, I'm here. What you knew is no more. This is the way that we're going to do things now. So it's really interesting that that extends even up to the VP level. Well, let's pivot a little bit. Alicia, I think we'll stick with you for this question. How would you describe the culture of engineering at Incident.io?
I would say highly collaborative, social, and engaging. We tend to work like closely together at all times to figure things out together. Like, I am the engineering manager. Within my role, I could very much like run off and make a bunch of decisions, but I don't. Me and Lisa work out together and we hash it out. And, you know, that's true for like engineering managers and tech leads, but also for like tech leads and engineers and engineers. It's like, let's work together to figure this out. We think a lot about trade-offs. Pace is a huge one for us that we talk about often. So for me, like, those things, collaboration, engagement, socialness, they like enable pace. They enable us making trade-offs and thinking about things in the way that we feel like is good and smart.
Yeah, I'd add to that as well that I think our culture is actually very structured, where, and I don't see that as a negative, but I think particularly compared to other small companies, we build a lot of structures to try and enable that collaboration and enable that pace.
Yeah.
So as an example, generally speaking, you're going to be on a project and there will be 2 to 4 people on the project that you're on. And I've worked in companies where you sit in a stand-up and basically everyone's doing their own thing. Like, everyone's picked their ticket off the Jira board. And there's some awareness of what you're doing, but mostly it's you and then maybe the tech lead is sort of split across everybody. And so you're kind of, if you were to try and like draw out everyone's lines of communication, you'd get something that looks like a fan where you basically have all of your ICs in a row, then you have like tech lead and engineering manager in the center.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we try and do is make sure that everybody's always like working with other people in the team, partly because it takes the burden off me as a tech lead. It means I can plausibly be on a project and be delivering because I'm not spread so thin. Mm-hmm. But also it means that you get a chance to learn from other people in your team and you get a chance to take on more responsibility as an IC. So one thing that we do here that I was really adamant that I wanted us to do, and I don't really think anyone disagreed with me on this, but having seen it go really wrong at GoCardless, was have engineers be project leads and be accountable. So I think in a lot of companies, project management is this kind of glue work that often it often falls on like a product manager because of their background, because they're often ex-consultants, they often have those skills, or they're the person who's accountable for delivery, so they end up doing it because no one else is doing it. Or it becomes like an engineering manager or a tech lead or a random person in the team who happens to be good at it. And to me, that's like a real anti-pattern. So one of the things that we saw as a result of that is that we didn't have people who were ready to be tech leads, because in the culture that I had at my previous company, all of that project management was going through that like tri-lead structure. And there was no stepping stone. There was no middle ground. You were either not doing it, in which case you weren't thinking about it. You weren't communicating with anybody outside your team. You were just picking up tickets, writing code. Or you were totally accountable for doing all of the communication. And the result was that it was really hard to find people who were good at that because no one was practicing and nobody could do it in a safe space. And I think if you take that and you make it a responsibility that's shared, that means that you can grow people into it. You've got someone who's leading a project for the first time. They're buddied with somebody who's done it 10 times. And then they can learn from that. There's somebody to kind of catch things when they fall. They've got me, they've got you to talk to. And I think that it's that structuredness that allows us to do things like that, because we are quite intentional about the way that we set up our team for the week. And that also comes with like documents. You know, we have a planning doc every week. And it's not a big document, but we sit in a room every week and go exactly who's going to be on what next week. And then when we want to make a change, we can pull a lever and be like, oh, this project, you know, we really need an extra person on it. It's top priority for the team. How do we flex? And it's like that structure is what allows us to be flexible and allows us to be to adapt to the situation. Whereas I think if you don't have that structure, it becomes really difficult because you can't point at the thing that's wrong almost.
Yeah, I guess it's like rather than having like one overarching thing with loads of tiny things that people are working on, you group. So in stand up, you might have seven people, for example, each talking about an individual thing. That's not how we do it in our stand-up. Our stand-ups are grouped up and three people will talk in stand-up about the project. When that means when something is going wrong, it's really easy to understand why from a project level rather than this sort of massive thing with loads of tiny little things that like one or two people need to be on top of or above. You make these sort of contained worlds that are easy to sort of understand and grok when something does go wrong. Is that a nice way to put it?
Lisa, you just mentioned pulling a lever, and I actually want to double tap on that in just a bit. But before that, you have a really interesting perspective because, like we said earlier, you were one of the, you know, founding engineers here. So I'm curious what your perspective is on how much things have changed between, you know, those early days and today.
I think something that I found quite comforting is I think our values haven't really changed. So what we're trying to do, the way we're trying to do it, is basically the same. You know, I would always say, I want us to be the fastest engineering team in London. We want to deliver really high quality products. We want to have a really good time while we do it. Those things are all true now, and if not like more true than they were in the early days. I think the things that changes is the way that that looks with two engineers versus the way that that looks with 25 is obviously different. So it's kind of the mechanisms change and there's obviously a lot more process because you don't need that much process where there's two of you and you're sat next to each other all day. And you need a lot more when there's, you know, we've got, what, three, nearly five teams that each of those teams operate independently. We need those teams to be able to communicate with each other. We need those teams to work internally as well. And also we've got new people coming into the business. We've got to build new relationships. Like, in right at the beginning, primarily it was me and Lawrence doing all the engineering and we had worked together previously. So we were coming in with a pre-baked way of working, understanding of each other. Onboarding in that environment is very different. Whereas when you start introducing new engineers, it's like, how do we work together? How do we get the best out of each other? I know how to get the best out of Lawrence because we've worked together so closely, but I don't necessarily have a good sense of that. Of most of the engineers, if I've not worked with them before. And I think that there's a lot more of that, like figuring stuff out. There's a lot more intentionality around what we're trying to do and just being a bit more explicit as you grow because you've got people coming from much more different environments. So as another example, there are certain things where, so GoCardless or GC was the place that me and Lawrence used to work at. And when we'd be talking about things, we'd obviously use that as a point of reference because that was a culture and an environment that we both experienced, which you can't really do anymore because you're sat in a room of 10 people and only two of them were in that environment. And so you start to get a load of input from other people, which is really exciting. And you start to be able to say, oh, we saw the bad version at the place that we were, but like, who's seen a good version of this? Yeah. And what made it good? And you can start to bring in those opinions from lots of different people to help us drive the outcomes that we want to drive. So like Alicia is a great example of this, comes in as an engineering manager. I don't think anything's changed about what we want to do, but you come with a whole load of new like ideas and ways of working that can help us achieve those things.
Yeah, for sure. I think like kind of what you're talking about is culture add, right? Yeah. Like, and we talk a lot about culture fit and growing culture, but I think it's really important to have like diverse opinions from different companies, different experiences, different like cultures, like backgrounds, and bringing that all into a room and being like, what do we do? How do we do this well is like really, really important. I think, you know, when it comes to sort of making change, it's more about like from the beginning, you know, I joined when there was 10 engineers and now we're like 25. It's noticing change and noticing patterns of work. And then when it comes to adding process to that, it's documenting what already exists rather than creating a new process. So I guess like that's the way that I would look at it. It's like adding opinions, adding thoughts, noticing how we change and documenting it.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we do a lot in retros where you're basically sort of, you're trying to look for those things that happen by accident and make them on purpose. So you're like, you know, sometimes in a retro, you're sat there and win. We did that. That was a terrible idea. Let's not do that again. Mm. And you send out your retro notes to the team being like, hey, you know, don't make this mistake that we made. It didn't feel good. But the flip side is also true where you do something and you're like, oh, if we did this on all projects, that would be great.
Yeah.
And I think that, and that's how you build up your kind of processes and your ways of communicating and ways of working. It's like you basically try things and see what sticks. And the challenge is making sure that when you find something that works, you keep doing it and you keep iterating on it rather than finding, it's like, you know, you find the diamond in the rough and then you forget about it and you walk away because you get too distracted by the next like challenge that you've got in front of you. I think that's one of the big value adds also of having engineering managers, having people who are in roles where they're thinking about culture very actively. Because if you are thinking about delivery, which is still, I mean, even my like primary focus, it's really difficult to make space for that. Like, what can we do better? What can we do differently? Why did this work? Not just like, did it go well? Did it go badly? And it's like taking you up to that next level from just assessing the like output, I guess, through to being like, what were the things that made it go well? How do we repeat that? How do we help train other people to be able to do that thing that you could do that maybe other people wouldn't have been able to do and sort of spreading that. And it becomes a bit of like, I don't know, I have this horrible image in my head that I'm like failing to turn into an analogy of, I don't know if it's the thing in science where you drop like a purple, like a crystal into water and it like spreads and it's supposed to show you about diffusion. Anyway, in my head, it's like something like spreading through an organization. That's kind of how I view culture. And you're trying to work out how do you like amplify that and how do you get the good bits and like amplify them through.
Makes me think of fungi.
Yeah, but that was worse. But I think what I went with was also appalling, so it may just all need to go.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah,
One day we'll have a great analogy for that and everyone will be like, oh my God, it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That wasn't the
Before we talk about what we mean by pulling a lever, I wanted to very quickly ask, we say like it's important to account for different perspectives and opinions, you know, as you continue to scale. It might be easy to account for their perspectives and their way of working, but does that change once you're adding, you know, a 10th person, a 15th person? Like your intentions may be exactly the same. Like we are going to be very accommodating, listen to people's perspectives, you know, factor that in. But I can imagine that doing that is difficult at scale because you're just accounting for so many more perspectives. Is that a right read?
I think it can be difficult if you're not thinking about it and you're just letting things happen. But for us, we're very, very intentional about hiring, who we want to hire, the types of people, the types of mindset that we want in the team. So like that's the first thing. And then the second thing is onboarding. So for me, like one of the in your onboarding doc that I create, it's the first thing is like be a sponge. take everything in, learn. And it goes back to what I was saying of like, do nothing, like understand what we do and why we do it, and then make suggestions. Because it's the same thing, whether you're an EM, whether you're VP or an engineer, coming in and trying to influence and make change straight away, you're going to like, you know, get people's backs up. You're going to be like, well, you don't understand why. And I think that then you start to create conflict and you start to have those challenging discussions. So if you set the expectation from the very beginning, you hire the people with the mindset that you want, and then you set that expectation of to be a sponge and understand why first. When suggestions do start to come in from those people, they make a lot more sense to the environment that we have and the type of sort of culture that we want to grow here.
I think the other thing I'd add to that is I think documentation is really important as part of that. So it's really hard to challenge a culture that no one's admitted is there. And it's much easier to challenge something when someone's written a document that says, this is the thing we care about. Mm-hmm. These are the trade-offs that you'll make, that we want to make. This is the way we want to work. These are the processes we want to have. Because then if you turn up and, you know, you've done your sort of 4 to 6 weeks and there's something that doesn't feel right, you can look at the document and kind of go, is this work as planned or work done? Mm-hmm. Is this what's supposed to be happening? Or is this like something a little bit off? And that's really useful as a way of trying to understand what is your next step. Because if you disagree with the document, then you can have a conversation about that document. And again, it becomes kind of attack the problem, not attack the person.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I actually disagree with the premise here. I think that you could get a different outcome via this route. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
If you're not seeing that in the document and you agree with the document, but you don't agree with what's happening, you're still in a really good position because you can be like, hey, I read this document. I thought that made a load of sense. I really buy that. I don't necessarily feel like we are living to that right now.
Yeah.
What can we do to sort of get back to that? Or have we deliberately changed?
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of that is much easier if you can anchor yourself to something explicit, because it kind of gives you the permission in a way to actually challenge something.
Yeah, I think it's like, just for me, it's thinking about all of these things actively and not letting them passively go by you, or it's being really, really purposeful about it.
So I'd like to get back around to pulling a lever. So at least I think it was you that mentioned this. Can you explain what we mean by that? Alicia, I actually think that you might be best equipped to answer that question.
So like pulling a lever, I guess another way and maybe a more common way of saying it is like knowing what tools you have in your toolbox. So if there is something that has changed or gone wrong or something that has gone right, it's understanding what you can do to like sort of influence that. So if a project's off track, it's making sure my engineers know that they can message me or Lisa and say, this is off track, I need more people, or this is off track, I need to cut scope. Whatever that lever is, it's being able, basically making sure that your engineers know what they are and how to use them and when to use them. And I think levers change often as well, and they're constantly introduced and some fall off the radar. And there's often times where you need to remind people, hey, we should be doing this. And hey, don't forget that you can do this. And it's like, yeah, great, thank you. So I think like, it fits really nicely into culture as something that you have to sort of, remind people that they have these things that they can use. So you might want to look at it as tools in your toolbox. We call it levers. But I think it's incredibly important that people know how they can make change and make things better.
Yeah, it's that empowerment point, which I think is normally the point that goes wrong. Like most companies do have the ability to flex those things, but I think they often like really underuse them. The plan becomes like the status quo to the extent that it feels like such a big emotional sort of hurdle to change the plan.
Yep.
And so like that's one thing that we care a lot about, and we talk a lot about being able to change those plans and flex things. But it's also like empowering people to say something when they think something isn't right.
Yep.
And it's so easy to accidentally end up in a culture where that just isn't happening anymore. And there's like, you know, there's a little bit sort of broken windows theory of, oh, well, this is just always bad and it always feels bad, so I'm just going to be here feeling bad. And making sure that everyone is aligned on what we think good looks like and whether we think we should be in that good place right now, or, you know, maybe there is some external factor that means that we can't be this week. But we should all be aligned on what we think we should be. Like, where do we think that the team should be this week? And then if that doesn't happen, what are the options that we have to do something about it? And one of the most impactful things I think you can do to help that is to listen to people when they pull a lever.
Yeah.
And like, the problem is you have to do that 10 times. And if on the 11th time somebody pulls a lever and it doesn't work, then they won't do it for like 3 months.
Yeah. And you took the words out of my mouth in that, like, the most important thing when someone does pull that lever is to react to it. Because if you don't, they're like, you're basically just like waving a flag in the dark, like, oh, help me, help me. And then so like, you're not going to ask for help again. You're not going to ask for that support again. So when that lever is pulled, it's like, you're on. It's being incredibly reactive. If Lisa comes up to me in the afternoon and I'm typing away in a document and he says, I need to talk to you about something, let's go. Let's sort this out and hash it out and talk right now, because that is the most important thing to enable engineers, tech leads, whoever it is that you're working with, to move quickly and do what they need to do. So most important part of pulling levers is react. Yeah.
You actually both answered the question I was going to follow up with, is like, I can imagine as someone who's pulling a lever. So I think I remember in the conversation that I had with Lisa a few months back on how to run meetings that don't suck, I think one of the things that you mentioned was like being able to pull that lever in a meeting that's like just wandering, like the objective that you set is not the objective that you're getting to in that meeting. People are off doing this, that, and the third, and being able to pull that lever and to say, we're not doing this right now. We need to come back once everybody's organized, so on and so forth. But my question was going to be, I can imagine that being the person pulling that lever can feel quite, I guess, icky, for lack of a better word. Like, you're the person coming in and saying, no, 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 I know that we had these plans, but I don't think they feel right. I can imagine that, like, doing that just feels a bit disruptive, and people are looking at you like, well, now you're the reason we aren't doing this. And what I was going to ask was, like, how do we make sure that we're both communicating that a lever, this lever is a thing that we want people to actively pull, but when they are pulling it, we're not ostracizing them or making them feel like, wow, now you pulled the lever, now everything is ruined. But I think you both answered that question already.
I think I have a little bit more to add to that, if it's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Especially in that sort of meeting room setting, there's like, there's two things. There's example setting, so having someone like Lisa do that often, or even somebody that's not a tech lead, you know, like maybe Isaac, for example, one of our more senior engineers, doing that and getting a good reaction to it. Oh, great thought, Isaac, let's discuss. So other people in the room can see that happen and be like, oh, maybe I can do that. I think the other thing is, as an EM, as a TL, is asking those questions to that person, like, hey, this feels a little bit off, should we talk about scope? And letting them think about it and be like, oh, well, yeah, actually, maybe we should. But if you're not like opening the door to that and being like, hey, we can talk about this thing now if it's important. This feels off to me. Does it feel off to you? You know, that's another way to like encourage them to start thinking about those levers and pulling them more often.
There's a lot of don't shoot the messenger.
Mm.
You can have a bad outcome. And that may well be because people on a project made bad choices. The thing that you must never punish is finding out that there's been a bad outcome. Like, bad news is good, because if I don't know something's going wrong, I can't help. Can't help.
Yeah.
And so there's a way that you can explicitly reward when somebody comes to you and says, oh, this is not where I wanted it to be, or this doesn't feel great. Your initial response, you have to mask the bit of your brain that might be going, oh, I'm really grumpy that this has gone badly, cannot come out, right? Yeah. Like, your first reaction has to be, oh, really glad that we're talking about this. Let's figure out how to problem solve. And later, in a retro, there might be a bit of, oh, how did we actually get there? That doesn't feel like we necessarily made the right trade-offs. But if that's the first reaction that you have, is immediately being like, well, why are we in the bad state? It feels negative, it feels scary, you don't want to say it. Whereas if your first reaction is, great, how do we fix it? And then you sort of leave the, like, how did we get here for a bit later. It becomes a much more positive thing.
Yeah. Nothing to add.
Smash it.
You did.
Yeah.
So let's talk about our values for a second. Alicia, would you be able to speak to how they've evolved over time? And one of the values that I'm actually really, really curious to sort of double tap on is our embrace the chaos value.
Yeah. So, like, you know, when I joined, I think we had less values.
We had a values interview.
Yeah.
And we didn't really have values.
Yeah.
We just had a values interview.
Yeah.
That had some values in it.
I think it's like, it goes back to that beginning bit of like that intentional culture, right? Like, the founders kind of know what vibe and what culture they're looking for. So it's like interviewing for that. I think the way that it's evolved over time is like the growth of the business and wanting and needing more structure. So embrace the chaos, for example, when you're in a scrappy startup, there's 10 engineers, it's like, yeah, let's like everything's like, da, 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 and you're trying to like figure it out. And it's like, embrace that, and things are going to go wrong, and customer requests are going to come in, and we're going to tell you, no, not that, this, stop doing that, do this instead. And like, it's really important that you're able to like rapidly context switch multiple times a day, and it's going to be annoying and it's going to be frustrating, but I need you to be able to handle that and take that in your stride. I think how that's evolved over time is we want to still be reactive and be able to context switch and figure things out, but we don't want it to be chaotic. You know, we've got more junior engineers in the team now. We've got a lot more people. There's, you know, different parts of the organization that need to interact with each other. Having 80 people running around is not great and is the bad part of chaos that we don't want to embrace. So the way that we thought about it and thought about changing that is, it's not about embracing chaos, but finding a way to get something done, regardless of what that is, regardless of if that's like someone jumping on a plane to bring swag to Amsterdam because we ran out of it, or whether that's like breaking, like stopping a project or pausing a project for a sort of a high value feature request coming in. It's like getting people into the mindset of, what can we do to make this thing happen, rather than let's run around like headless chickens.
I would argue that we were never fully headless chickens.
We weren't fully.
We were just somewhat headless at times.
Yeah, maybe we like run around like semi-headless. What's the Harry Potter guy?
Nearly headless Nick. I think embracing the chaos was one of the things we really wanted, was, as Alicia was saying, like people who are comfortable not sticking to the plan.
Yeah.
And where that doesn't sort of make them very, very anxious. I think now we're in a place where we stick to the plan a lot more, bluntly, because we have a lot more structure. We have a lot more people that gives us more flex.
Yeah.
And so that in and of itself becomes less important. And what becomes more important is the like, how good are you at sort of enumerating all of the possible solutions and finding the one that is going to fix the problem?
Mm.
And how comfortable are you with the fact that that might be a bit uncomfortable?
Yeah.
It's like making difficult decisions, having difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. No one wants to pause their project that they're halfway through. It feels rubbish, but sometimes that is the right decision. Mm. And there's a pragmatism there as well. And there's like a comfort with that. Ultimately, we as a whole company have goals that are at company level. And sometimes there will be a goal that's at a higher level that is more important than your sort of micro goal of that project. And being sort of up for that and excited for that, and being like, yeah, I can contribute to the business more meaningfully by doing this other higher priority thing, rather than getting very caught up with the like, well, this is what I thought I was going to achieve this week.
Yeah.
And now I can't achieve my little thing. And now I'm upset and I don't feel good about it. And I'm coming home feeling like quite deflated.
I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier about being able to have a problem and be like, all right, let's find the way to fix it, and we'll think about how we got here later. It's like the same thing, right? But maybe we're talking about it like a bit more of an org level than a team or project level. But it's like, let's stop, let's figure the thing out, and then later on we'll be like, where did this project come from, and like how can we like change this or make this better or make this not feel so bad next time. Those conversations can happen later. Let's like find a way right now.
Well, I'd love to end on asking each of you what your favorite part of our culture is. Lisa, let's start with you.
I think I would say the relationships that we have with our customers. Ooh. So I came from a fintech, and direct debit is really important. And businesses literally like wouldn't run without it. No one is excited about the direct debit provider. I can tell you that with a lot of experience. Nobody turns up like bounding into a room being like, oh my God, I just had this incredible conversation with this customer. They're so happy with this thing you shipped. Like that had never happened to me until I was at this company. And I think that there is a culture of trying to really plug everybody into our customers.
Mm.
Like they're the people who are paying us. They're the people who are keeping this business alive. They're why we're here. And so the fact that I get to see all of that feedback coming in Slack in particular, and in like little snippets from calls where when somebody says something nice about something you've built, for me, it makes me feel amazing. I'm like a child that's been given a gold sticker, and that just keeps happening, and it's still happening now. And I think as the company scaled, we found different ways of making sure that happens. But ultimately, I'm still in the customer channels with some of our like key stakeholders in our biggest customers. And I see kind of firsthand the feedback, the experiences they're having with the product. And that's that's the thing that makes me go, oh, I'm going to build this really well. And that's what keeps my quality bar high. That's what keeps my energy levels high. And that's what helps like me deliver back to those customers. And it's that loop, which is if you don't have it, it's kind of really hard to spin it up. It's like kind of momentum building. But once it's there, it's this really lovely kind of feedback loop where you ship something great and a customer thinks it's great. And they're like, oh, I had a really good time with this. It was a really like lovely moment for me. And then you go and ship the next thing really well because you're excited from that feedback. So yeah, the idea that you can always talk to customers, that we have lots of visibility over what customers are saying. We don't really like shield people in the company from our customers in any way, which is totally unlike anywhere I've been before. And I just find that like a massive energy boost.
I think for me, my favorite part is like this. It's like seeing, someone it's Lisa.
I'm her favorite part.
It's just
culture.
Lisa. Yeah. it's like the joy and happiness that everyone has coming into work, whether it's the energy from customers or energy from figuring something hard out, right? It's the relationships, it's the dynamic, it's us sitting down and hashing something out, or me seeing Lisa do that with Sam or someone else in the team, and I'm walking past and I'm just like, yeah, vibes, and everyone's excited and hyped, and I'm like, that's what I love coming in. I love that everybody loves coming in to the office and working together and wants to hang out with each other and do good things and ship nice things for our customers, and that's my favorite part.